crash, blast, mass, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, we discuss the multifaceted opposition to mandatory vaccination policies like those proposed in California Senate Bill 277. While public health is one of the main frames used by corporate media and many advocates of the bill, today's guests consider other related frames often ignored in the public debates, specifically the many legal, ethical, and civil rights concerns and the issue of informed consent. We'll speak with two attorneys about vaccine injury, case law, and public awareness regarding patients' rights. We'll hear from a medical ethicist, a professor of clinical ethics who sits on a hospital board. We'll hear from independent journalists and parents, all on the Project Censored Show. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we discuss the multifaceted opposition to mandatory vaccination policies like those proposed in California SB 277. And while public health is one of the main frames used by corporate media and many advocates of the bill, today's guests consider other related frames oft ignored in the public debate, specifically the many legal, ethical, and civil rights concerns of the issue of informed consent. Our first two guests today are attorneys. We are joined by Caitlin Gilley-Obolsky. She's a California attorney working out of Berkeley. She focuses her practice on constitutional law and education-related issues. She ghostwrites legal content and blog posts for law firms across the country for a national law information company. She's also a volunteer member of the Homeschool Association of California's legal team, and she joins us by phone. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we are also joined by attorney Robert Krakow. And Robert Krakow is an attorney in private practice in New York City. He is an accomplished trial lawyer and former New York County prosecutor who has represented individuals in civil and criminal matters in federal and state courts. Among his areas of expertise, Robert specializes in representing individuals with vaccine injuries. And, of course, he has a much longer CV, and you can learn more about that at KrakowLaw.com. We'll be giving websites throughout the program. Robert, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you for having us.
Caitlin, let's start with you. Let's just go and get a really quick primer. What is SB 277 in California? Give people just a really quick background, and then let's start getting into particularly some of your legal opinions and views on what's going on with SB 277.
Okay. SB 277, it stands for Senate Bill 277. It was introduced, I believe, this February in response to several cases of measles that followed alleged outbreak at Disneyland, and legislators were attempting to address what they perceived as an epidemic, which resulted in some 130 or something cases across the entire country from that event, not limited to California. And the prior law that had taken effect this school year was called Assembly Bill 2109, and that law, in tandem with California's personal belief exemption to these vaccination laws for school children, allowed parents to exercise a personal belief exemption to these mandatory vaccines so long as they met with a medical doctor and had a form stating that they had been informed of the potential risks of not vaccinating. So it has an informed consent requirement. So this was the first year that that AB 2109 took place. And just a few months after the year started, legislators took it upon themselves to declare that AB 2109 was not working and we needed further drastic measures. So they introduced this SB 277, which completely removed any personal belief exemptions, including religious exemptions, and allows parents to only forego vaccines if they have a letter signed by a medical care professional within very stringent guidelines and essentially makes it so that parents will have absolutely no choice regarding vaccinations from the time that their child is born, because some of the relevant vaccines are given literally on the first or second day of life, hepatitis C in particular. And this bill now, as amended, states that birth to preschool is a grade span under California law. So that's kind of what we're dealing with. Hopefully that's a broad enough of an overview on that.
A question that people ask is, this is framed as a public health issue or a public health concern. So why is it that, there are, a very diverse group of people opposed to SB 277, opposed to the idea of mandatory vaccination? And from your perspective, what are some of the legal reasons for this?
The Supreme Court case law that the government is relying on in passing this law is called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. It was decided in 1905 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it dealt with a very widespread epidemic of smallpox. And in response to that epidemic, the legislator at the city level passed a law that stated that all adults who didn't have medical contraindications needed to either be immunized for smallpox or pay a $5 fine, which is about the equivalent of a $120 fine now. And the plaintiff in that case, Jacobson, did not want to do it, so he challenged the law, and he did lose. And the court said, when there's a widespread epidemic that's essentially an emergency-like situation, and we have this vaccine that can potentially prevent future cases, it's okay in those very limited circumstances to require vaccination. Now, the two issues that stem from Jacobson are, one, is this case that was decided over 100 years ago and before we had many, many other very fundamental constitutional law cases decided by the Supreme Court, is Jacobson still a valid exercise of the police powers? And the second issue is whether it's lawful, and I think it's completely not, to extend the logic of one vaccination in the midst of a huge widespread epidemic that applied to adults. Is it lawful to expand that to apply to children and to require 10 times the number of vaccinations with no current epidemic? And one of the issues that has been continuing to recur in this SB 277 debate is, well, we had this measles outbreak in Disneyland and it was really terrible and people got really sick. Luckily, nobody died. Thank goodness for that. So legislators say, well, we had that measles outbreak, so why don't we go ahead and pass this law? And the answer to that question is the legislator has said that we have certain pockets in California where there's a lower than optimal level of immunization. Well, there's absolutely nothing preventing any of these municipalities from passing laws regarding vaccination. There's no reason why, when we have a nearly 98% immunization level statewide, that we should be having a statewide mandatory no exception law like SB 277.
Again, the idea is challenging those in an outbreak, and we can get into some more detail on SB 277 here in a little bit in the show that maybe also illustrates that this actually isn't a response technically to a factual outbreak given some of the amendments. But before we get into that, Robert Krakow, let's bring you in here because you have a long history dealing with vaccination issues and vaccine injuries in particular, which is a focus of your practice. Could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. Thank you. I did have an experience which alerted me back in 2002 that there was something called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which most lawyers don't know exists. I didn't know it existed. And in fact, it was set up in 1986 to compensate individuals who have vaccine injury. It was designed and ultimately gave almost complete immunity to the vaccine manufacturers for liability to vaccine injury. So I've been doing that since 2002. And I want to make the point that I don't think any of us come to this. Some people do, but I don't, and I doubt Caitlin does, ideologically opposed to vaccination. We believe that there should be choice, that if the government wants to promote a vaccine program, it can do that. But it has to give choice because vaccines can injure. Vaccines can offend some people's beliefs. And people should have the opportunity to do that. So what the government did here, the government, but more likely operatives in the industry, took less than 200 measles cases nationwide and claimed there was a public health emergency. But there is no public health emergency. As Caitlin explained, the Supreme Court law is predicated on the fact that vaccines can be mandated when there's a public health emergency. There is no public health emergency, and as you pointed out, vaccine uptake is at all-time highs. It hasn't decreased. So what is the basis to mandate vaccines with no exceptions when we know some individuals will be hurt? That's the question, and I don't think we've heard an answer. We just see, for whatever reason, whether they've been influenced by lobbyists or other misinformation, that the legislatures, and this is going on across the country, California is the bellwether state for this, and the most draconian legislation. So why is this happening? There is no emergency. It is not necessary. What we have effectively now in the United States, because of the public health policies and alliance with vaccine industry, for which vaccines have become a profit sector because they're losing other profit sectors, such as the patents are expiring on Vioxx and so on. Vaccines is a multi-billion dollar industry and growing. But there is no public health emergency, so there's no need to do this. So I think it's very destructive.
Robert Krakow, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Talk a little bit about the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Why is that federally mandated, and why can't people sue vaccine drug companies themselves if they're injured?
In the early 1980s, there was a high incidence of injury from the DPT shot, and parents started bringing this to the attention of authorities, and there were lawsuits, and they were very expensive for the vaccine industry. Whether or not it was legitimate, the vaccine industry threatened to withdraw from vaccine manufacturing. In response to that, there was something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that was enacted in 1986. It was supported by some vaccine manufacturers. It was supported by some groups of parents, although others opposed. And that is what we're living with today. It was unprecedented. It takes away from parents your right to sue vaccine manufacturers for most purposes. It takes away the right to jury trial, puts caps on damages, and allows discovery. Now, what happened shortly after that, that paved the way for the expansion of the vaccine program. So you had in the 90s the hepatitis B vaccine introduced, the Hib vaccine, then you had the varicella vaccine, and you have Prevnar in the early 2000s, the first blockbuster vaccine in terms of making money. Now you've had Gardasil and new meningitis vaccines. So the law paved the way for the expansion of the vaccine industry where we have it today. Now, it's very much in the interest of the vaccine industry to mandate vaccines because then uptake will be universal, and this is a new profit sector. It's not necessary to protect public health. Many of the vaccines that are being mandated, including the ones in SB 277 that don't have exceptions, are not contagious diseases. Hepatitis B is not spread from person to person. The vaccine Gardasil, there's no information as to whether it's effective or not in preventing cervical cancer.
And it has some negative side effects. Actually, Project Censored and PR Watch did a story on it in 2008, particularly right. The cell job, the big pharma cell job of it, and neglecting the possible side effects and dangers and deaths associated with it. And Robert Krakow, I just wanted to underscore one point again, and then we'll bring Caitlin Obolsky back in, that no one on the program here is advocating anti-vaccination standpoint. We have numerous guests on the show today, and to my knowledge, none of the guests are against the idea of immunization or against public health concerns. And that's a very important thing to bring up because that's one of the big frames used to attack and lump people that oppose SB 277 into the same category. It's utterly fallacious, and it is not factually supported. So I'm very glad that you brought that up. The one really quick question I had for you, Robert Krakow, and we want to go back to Caitlin, is can you give us a really quick overview or history of the vaccine injury, the compensation fund? Aren't we talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $3+ billion that's been paid out? And do you know how much has been paid out even in the last year and how many cases?
I don't have exact numbers, but something in excess of $3 billion is correct since 1988 when the program actually was implemented. And there are hundreds of cases being paid out, mostly in recent years for the flu vaccine, which, as you know, is almost universal and is completely ineffective. It had 19% effectiveness of efficacy, according to the CDC, and is routinely the wrong vaccine for the strain circulating. So there are many types of injuries, adults, children, and so on, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases being compensated. Annually, it's in the high hundreds. And I should make one more point, that this program has not been publicized. There was a recent government accountability report, and this goes to your theme in Project Censored. The law mandates that this program should be publicized, but we know that HHS, Health and Human Services Department, is not publicizing it, and it's reported right in the General Accountability Office's report. They're afraid that if they publicize the program, it will damage vaccine uptake. It will impair the vaccine program, but that's not acceptable because the law itself requires publicity. I think the number of cases that are brought in the vaccine injury compensation program is way below the number of vaccine injuries. We know that there's only a 10% reporting rate to the vaccine adverse event reporting system. Most people don't know about it. Doctors are supposed to report to that. They don't know about this program, and it's by design. The public health authorities do not want this program publicized because there's a conflict with their interest in promoting vaccination. And that also explains why the media doesn't report about this as much as they should. We're seeing something more in recent years, but it should be out there. People should know about it. People are being injured, and they deserve compensation.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're looking at the California Senate Bill 277. We're talking about the policies to push mandatory vaccinations. We're talking to two attorneys right now, Caitlin Obolsky, who's in Berkeley, California. We're also speaking with Robert Krakow in New York City. And we want to go back here to Caitlin Obolsky. And here is Peter Phillips, my co-host, with the next question.
Caitlin, you've written that free public education is a fundamental right under California law, and that this SB 277, you know, a mandated vaccination bill, could ban children from attending the classroom. And children with hepatitis B cannot be excluded from the classroom. Teachers with HIV cannot be excluded from the classroom. So why would it be that children who are unvaccinated would be excluded from the classroom?
Right. You know, the answer to that question is, of course, they can't. SB 277 basically relies on fear of contagion, which is a constitutionally prohibited reason for preventing children from accessing these fundamental rights. You spoke of the access to the free public education, which the California Supreme Court stated is a protected right in the case Serrano versus Priest. And they said that, you know, public education is really important to our society. It has lots of really great benefits. We want to have educated people in society. So this is something we're going to declare is a fundamental interest. And fundamental interests cannot just be cast aside because of the whims of the legislator. And I spoke of the fear of contagion, which was the case law you were referring to. In those cases, one of them was decided by the United States Supreme Court, which is the Arline case. Arline was decided in 1987, and there was a teacher that had tuberculosis, and the school district wanted to fire her because they were concerned that she might get the children sick. And the case went before the United States Supreme Court, and they said, just because you're concerned that she might possibly get someone sick is not a sufficient justification to remove her constitutionally protected right to maintain gainful employment. And in related case law, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the next highest federal court that has jurisdiction over California, just below the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a decision that was dealing with teachers, and they were, again, trying to exclude the teacher from the classroom. And in that opinion, they referred to a Second Circuit Court of Appeals case that literally dealt with children that had hepatitis B, and I think it was the American Medical Association served as expert witnesses or filed amicus briefs stating that hepatitis B cannot be transmitted in the typical classroom setting, and therefore excluding children who are afflicted with hepatitis B cannot constitutionally be kept out of the classroom. Therefore, it's completely suspicious why, if a child with hepatitis B cannot be kept out of the classroom, we're going to keep children out of the classroom who don't even have hepatitis B, but their parents want to decline the vaccination. And by the way, you cannot decline any of the vaccinations under SB 277, which includes hepatitis B.
Caitlin Obolsky, we also wanted to get to this issue of informed consent legally. This is a serious issue. A lot of folks may go to see their health practitioners And of course, we live in a culture where we trust these people. We trust experts. We certainly trust they have the best interests of their patients at heart. Even if we have different philosophies and maybe different ideas about things, we at least know that there are matter-of-fact differences between people as individuals, biologically, how people react to things. And of course, ultimately here, another issue outside of public health that, seems to get overlooked in the push for SB 277 in California is the idea that your right to know what's going on with your body or your right to have a say on what's going into your body somehow gets trumped by the idea of public health. Talk to us just a little bit about informed consent law, what that means, and then we want to go back to Robert Krakow for his view. Caitlin?
Informed consent is, like you said, basically the premise that you have the right to understand the various risks and complications associated with a medical procedure. And we have both U.S. Supreme Court and California Supreme Court decisions, those being Cruzon and Thor are the two cases, that say that you have the right to refuse medical treatment even when it may result in your certain death. In both of those cases, it dealt with life-saving treatment. So if you can refuse something that will save your life, the corollary is completely on point for these vaccinations. And by the way, many people may not be aware of the fact that under California law, we have tort reform, quote unquote. There's a doctrine called the learned intermediary doctrine under California law that applies to vaccines and applies to doctors, such that if your doctor is aware of the risks associated with vaccines and other medical procedures, and your doctor does not communicate those risks to you, you still cannot sue the vaccine manufacturer, even if those risks come into fruition because of this learned intermediary doctrine. Your doctor is shielded from liability under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, and the vaccine manufacturer is shielded from liability because of the learned intermediary doctrine. The risks are told to your doctor and your doctor absorbs them, therefore they are deemed under the law as having been given to you. And by the way, another area of the law that's being ignored here is the premise that under California law, product liability claims cannot be waived. And, you know, I don't really remember waiving any product liability rights to sue vaccine manufacturers if my child dies from the vaccine, and I haven't really met anybody else who has either. So I'm not really sure how we can have this federal law that is in complete contravention of the Seventh Amendment. Like Mr. Krakow mentioned, you know, you lose your Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. You have no judge. You have no discovery. The rules of evidence do not apply. The rules of federal civil procedure do not apply. But, oh, by the way, you still have to prove your claim in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program.
Robert, let's go back to you. I heard you say that there's a push here by profit motive companies, vaccine companies, to make this mandatory. And at the same time, they used the measles outbreak at Disneyland. It got a lot of attention. And so they said, okay, let's just go ahead for this. But at the same time, even though you're not opposed to vaccines, and many doctors feel that vaccines are the best thing since sliced bread for the human population, there is, in fact, a right of an individual to refuse service, medical care, and there have been adverse reactions from a variety of vaccines. Is that correct?
Yes. We don't really have informed consent because, first of all, what happens in most cases is there's a vaccine information sheet given to a patient, and it's handed over, and that's it. There's no guarantee that a patient has any idea what the safety considerations are for a vaccine. So the right to informed consent is not really being honored. It's being given short shrift. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we know that the overall public health policy is to push vaccination at all costs. But the authorities don't want there to be true informed consent, and in fact, the sanctions that they're placing, you can't participate in school if you don't get the vaccine, and it's going to get worse, and it's being applied to younger children, it's being applied to college-age children, it will be applied to adults, it's being applied in the workplace. There's a plan to take away certain entitlements if you don't get vaccination. That is really coercion, and that makes a mockery of informed consent. So even if you did have true informed consent with true information that people were aware of and it was publicized, if you have these serious sanctions for failing to comply, is that really informed consent? You can't participate in society. Your kid can't go to school. Maybe in the future you can't get a driver's license. You can't get Medicaid benefits or Medicare benefits or other government benefits if you don't get vaccinated. And I see that coming. There's been a long-range plan to tie vaccination to certain public rights, education, other entitlements.
There are bills parked but pending. They're being discussed and introduced gradually in over 20 states to basically do SB 277. Right now, however, there are only a couple states that have these more radical type laws. Now, again, the issue here, the interesting point is, like, you sure you can still say you don't want to receive these immunizations and you don't want your child to for whatever reasons. But the issue is then is people are being denied public education rights. But isn't Billy or Sally still going to be able to play with the kids on the playground? Aren't they going to pass each other on the street? I mean, what's the targeting here? What's the logic of the targeting other than coercion?
Well, not only that doesn't make sense because it doesn't really protect the public by excluding kids from school, but, you know, the vaccines themselves create carriers. So the DPT vaccine, pertussis component, those outbreaks in recent years have been found to occur in vaccinated children. Why is that? And we're finding that there are children who get the pertussis vaccine who are asymptomatic, are in fact carriers. They got the vaccine, but now they're carriers of the disease and they're going to school. But public health policy doesn't accommodate all these considerations. It's a one-size-fits-all, oh, you don't get vaccinated, you don't go to school. That's a coercive measure. Does it really protect public health? And I would submit that it doesn't in most cases, and it's not for the benefit of the population. It's really to promote one thing: get those vaccines out there at all costs, regardless of injury, regardless of whether it's effective, regardless of whether the vaccine's effective, regardless of whether the vaccine is protecting against a truly contagious disease that's infectious and spread by contact. So the public health policies don't make sense. The only thing that explains it all is that there's a push to expand this growing profit sector that emerged in the last 20 years, and that was facilitated by the Vaccine Act of 1986.
Robert Krakow, attorney since 1979, your own firm since 1989, specializing in vaccine injury cases out of New York City. Thanks so much for joining the Project Censored show
today. Thank you so much.
Caitlin Obolsky, let's go back to you for the last word in this segment. On the same point, talking about the idea of not having children have the right to attend school, what do you see the rationale, the logic behind this? You just heard Robert Krakow talk about coercion, and I know you're affiliated with Homeschool Association of California. Could you give us your view on this?
Yeah, sure. Two points that you guys, in the course of this discussion, have brought up is this applies to all school settings. So it's not only the public education, which is protected by the California Constitution and the California Supreme Court has said fundamental interest. It's literally any school setting. So even if you only decline one vaccination or you want to do a delayed vaccine schedule, your child cannot go to any school in the state. And in regards to the mandated vaccines, the hearings have repeatedly focused on measles, and there has been a discussion of pertussis. But if you look at SB 277, there's a total of 10 vaccinations. There hasn't been any justification for why children must receive all 10 if we haven't had any, you know, communicable disease outbreaks for these other diseases. And a good example of this is another bill that's before the California legislature, SB 792. Now, this bill was introduced to apply to daycare employees. And when it was first introduced, it only applied to measles, or it only required, rather, measles, pertussis, and flu. And so when I saw that, I was like, uh-oh, they might actually get this bill through. Arguably, you could say that that's legally sufficient.
And the flu had like a 23% efficacy rate. I mean,
right. So, but here's what happened. At the first hearing, they amended the bill to include all CDC-recommended vaccinations for daycare workers, and they created two exemptions, which were the flu shot and HPV. So that is a really good example, taken in tandem with SB 277, of the fact that this is not about this recent small contained outbreak. is literally about getting everybody to follow the entire CDC schedule, whether they want to or not.
And Caitlin Dabalski, this is also the case. You mentioned whooping cough, and there was a case in Salinas recently where almost everybody there was vaccinated. Again, California-wide, we're above the herd immunity percentage, although it's true that in some communities, there is concern that the number has dropped below this. But, you know, there was just an article in Wired Magazine recently that was arguing, yes, public health is important, yes, immunization is important, but education is important about vaccines, and people should be educated. And again, getting rid of the personal choice and mandating this isn't necessarily the best way to go when you're balancing so many different factors.
Yeah, I think that's exactly on point. And I think also, like you guys have stated, we're not anti-vaccination. In fact, we fully follow the vaccination schedule in consultation with our board-certified pediatrician. And if you pass a bill like SB 277, you're going to make it so that individuals who do have concerns about vaccines will not be getting the access to their doctors, because we've seen that doctors are kicking people out of their practices if they do not fall into step and follow that schedule. So it's literally, like Mr. Krakow said, a mockery of informed consent. If you want to raise a question about a vaccine, your child cannot go to school, you cannot get an appointment with your doctor, and so what's going to happen? People just aren't going to go to doctors, and I think that's going to be a potentially greater public health emergency.
Well, Caitlin Dabalski, attorney at law in Berkeley, California. You're associated with Homeschool Association of California, and you write at callawmama.com, CALAWMAMA.com. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll be right back after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we've been discussing the multifaceted opposition to mandatory vaccination policies like those proposed in California Senate Bill 277. And we've been emphasizing, of course, that while public health is one of the frames used by corporate media and many advocates of the bill, our guests today are considering other related frames oft ignored in the public debate. Specifically, the many legal questions that we just had. And now we're going to turn to some of the media coverage of this issue. And we're also going to talk about ethical and civil rights concerns, as well as the issues of informed consent. And we'll probably also be getting into some of the big pharma connections to doctors and pushing some of these agendas. Right now, we are joined by Dr. Elliot Cohen. He's a professional ethicist and philosophical counselor. He's editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Applied Philosophy and executive director of the National Philosophical Philosophical Counseling Association, president of the Institute of Critical Thinking, National Center for Logic-Based Therapy. Elliot Cohen's also a blogger for Psychology Today, and he teaches many courses in applied and professional ethics, and he's the author of 25 books. Elliot Cohen, you join us today by phone.
Good to be here.
And here is Peter Phillips to introduce our next guest, investigative journalist Cheryl Atkinson. Peter?
Cheryl Atkinson is an Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist and author of the New York Times bestseller Stonewalled. She became a Washington-based correspondent for CBS News in 1995. Prior to that, she co-anchored CBS News Up to the Minute. Before joining CBS, Atkinson was an anchor and correspondent for CNN. And in addition to her CBS duties, Atkinson hosted a half-hour weekly medical news magazine for PBS entitled Health Week. Cheryl, there, are you with us?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being on. I just want to really get right into this. SB 277 is proposing to mandate vaccinations here in California for all school children. How does corporate media cover vaccinations? Are they fair about the issues?
I would say, based on my experience and also speaking with colleagues, my extensive experience in trying to report on medical issues, that the news media is very much, in my view, controlled by the interests of the pharmaceutical industry. And this was exemplified by stories I did years ago for CBS, along with many others in the news media, where we were honing in on vaccine safety issues such as the question of autism, obviously not being anti-vaccine in any sense or in any way, but factually following this story like any other, but coming under extraordinary pressure from many different interest groups, a lot of them backed by the pharmaceutical industry in a cloaked fashion that is not transparent, and from the pharmaceutical industry directly, lobbying, calling, and objecting and trying to stop and censor these stories. And to a large degree, in my view and that of other journalists who've gone through the same experience, they've been very effective. A lot of this coverage has stopped. The story is now treated as though there is no argument that so-called science is settled, that anybody who even speaks of these issues is anti-vaccine. All of that is factually false, but I think it's largely treated that way by the news media.
Cheryl Atkinson, you've been writing about medical issues for years. You've been writing about the vaccine issues for years. And I know that you have been attacked for some of the articles that you've done. And you did. You mentioned the CBS stories you've done, including Gardasil, HPV, military vaccine dangers, and so forth. You've also analyzed some of the claims by experts on the pro-mandatory vaccination side, particularly Paul Offit. What I wanted to ask you is that one of the stories that you did in the past year that had some significance that's starting to get some attention was the CDC whistleblower case. Could you tell us a little bit about your research on that case?
Well, this was just like many others where there is evidence that comes forward from a credible source. In this case, a sitting senior scientist with CDC who stepped forward to say that not only did he mislead the public in a published study about autism and vaccines, not only did he work to downplay an association between vaccines and autism rates in young black boys, but he says that his colleagues at CDC were complicit in this and it was not the only time they've done such a thing. And this has been a story that has not been well told, but has certainly been discussed and circulated and known among journalists and others who have tried to cover the issue. But that story has gotten very little attention, and of course all sides that are, I believe, in many respects controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, more susceptible in a well-meaning fashion, but susceptible to the propaganda that's been put out by this industry, have come forward and tried to, attack what he's saying. I don't really see how you can take a sitting CDC senior scientist who's disparaging his own published study at his own peril and say that he's somehow being disingenuous about it for some motivation. But this is, to me, a headline front, top center story that got very little, if any, mainstream media attention.
And it's also worth pointing out, Cheryl Atkinson, that William Thompson at the CDC is also a pro-vaccine researcher. Like many of the people, in fact, I believe all the people on the program we have here today, no one is against the idea of vaccinations or immunizations. What we're focusing on, however, is a multifaceted face of the opposition to something like SB 277. And you're bringing up some very important connections and also bringing up another important angle here at the Project Censored Show. And that's the partial media accounting of some of these problems that you have dug up as an investigative journalist. And also, The one point that's worth repeating that you mentioned, I'd like to hear you say more on this if you could, is that the way the corporate media in particular is spinning this is that anybody that questions the idea of mandating this is immediately smeared as a, quote, anti-vaxxer, end quote. And then that has all these images that are conjured up of sort of like hippie moms and flat earthers and science denialists and anti-science people and so forth. I mean, that's a really successful caricature to demonize people that ask questions. But the reality of the people that are comprising the movement opposing to this bill is vastly different than that caricature.
It is part of a well-thought-out, well-orchestrated, and largely successful campaign to try to stop people from discussing an issue that the propagandists, the industry, the supporters, and those who are well-meaning who are susceptible to their propaganda, they want to stop this talk, and the way to stop it is to just call names, kind of ridiculous names of anybody who has questions. I would argue that seeking the safest vaccination policy possible is very pro-vaccine. I think there's nothing more harmful to a vaccination program than injuries that could potentially be prevented and the public becoming scared that the government is hiding that or not doing its best to try to make things safest. That, to me, if anything, would be considered anti-vaccine or harmful to the vaccine program. Whereas those trying to make the vaccine program safer and expose any risks and hopefully mitigate those risks is very pro-vaccine. And on another level, I argue that the whole idea of pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine is a silly term because it's like saying, are you pro-medicine? In other words, do you believe that all medicine should be given to all people, no matter what their age or condition, under all circumstances? Of course not. All vaccines are not equal. All vaccines are not equally necessary. All are not equally tolerated, and all are handled differently by the biology of an individual person. We accept that with medicine in general, and yet supposed scientific minds don't want people to think that about vaccinations, which is silly. We know vaccines have varying levels of safety because the intravenous polio vaccine carries no risk of giving you polio, and that's still on the market. However, the oral polio vaccine carries a slight risk of giving you polio, and Americans did get polio from that vaccine until it was pulled from the market not so long ago. And at one point, there were both vaccines on the market until the government agreed it was unethical to offer babies one vaccine that might give them polio and another that would not give them polio. Why are you giving people that choice and also not explaining that choice? So the oral was pulled off the market. But there are many cases like that that show the term anti-vaccine and pro-vaccine is itself, I think, a misnomer.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Cheryl Atkison. You can learn more at CherylAtkison.com, CherylAtkison.com. I'd like to bring Professor Elliot Cohen into the discussion. Cheryl Atkison just mentioned ethics as an issue here, and that's an area of expertise for you. You are involved teaching on medical and clinical ethics, and you also, I believe, are active on a hospital board dealing with ethical concerns. Is that right, Elliot?
That's right. Yes.
Well, Elliot, chime in here. Riffing off of what you just heard Cheryl Atkison saying, let's start talking about some of the ethical concerns you have on this issue.
For every ethical argument, there's always another side. And the side that the media is really hushed up on is obviously the side that raises questions about the safety of these various vaccines, notably the MMR. As far as SB 277, well, why is there a desire to have such a bill come forward and preempt the decisional powers of parents? Well, the argument that is being held, whether it's disingenuous or not, is just this, that it's necessary in order to create what's called a herd immunity, which is 95% immunization rate, to avoid epidemics of diseases like measles. And other children, so it's argued, have the right to safe school environments. And if parents have personal belief exemptions, then they'll threaten the welfare of these children, these other children. So that's the argument that's out there. And on the face of it, it sounds reasonable. We don't want to harm innocent children. The question, however, is this argument addressing the complexities of the issues at stake? And it really isn't. It's rather oversimplified, and there's a number of objections to it. Those who choose to be vaccinated are still presumably protected from getting infected by those who haven't been vaccinated. So if there are a large number of individuals who are being vaccinated, they can't claim that those children are going to the at-risk, except for the very few and very rare where the vaccine, you know, fails and is ineffective on those individuals who are vaccinated. That leaves only a relatively few individuals who may have medical excuses for not being vaccinated. Those are the individuals, those who have medical excuses for not being vaccinated, that might be concerned about this. The large expanse of individuals, populations of individuals who are prepared to get vaccinated, who are protesting the loudest, really have the least to be afraid of. But still, we definitely are concerned about any individuals, any children who are at risk. But the welfare of these at-risk individuals, as small a number as they may be, needs to be weighed against the possibility of harmful side effects of vaccines, in particular diseases like autism. And given that one out of every 68 children have autism, this could be millions of children who are at risk.
Elliot Cohen, again, the idea that there are immunocompromised people and the herd immunity idea is protecting these people, that certainly is understandably an ethical argument. But there's also $3 billion, more than $3 billion been paid out by a vaccine and compensation fund set up by the federal government to provide liability protection to big pharmaceutical companies and vaccine manufacturers. Why would those people not also get some of that ethical concern and then leave in place the notion of informed consent? In other words, given that California does have a high rate of vaccinations and in some pockets it may be lower, is this kind of a bill actually even necessary, throwing informed consent out the window?
Informed consent is something that we all need, even those, especially those who are engaging in taking the vaccines. Those individuals who are vaccinated, because of the kinds of points that Cheryl Atkinson was making, that the media is remiss in making it clear what the risks are, these individuals aren't given informed consent, so they're going into the lion's den and making decisions based upon inadequate information. And the media, you know, is charged with providing that information, and it's falling asleep at the wheel.
Elliot Cohen, we need to emphasize, of course, that no one on our program today is anti-vaccine. But there are cases where vaccines have adverse reactions, and there's quite a number of cases. If $3 billion has been awarded out for vaccine damage, I think the question becomes, big pharma, pharmaceutical companies, are pushing a mandated vaccine agenda. And that includes not only MMR, but a dozen other vaccines, and increasingly possibility of many, many more that would be added into that for not only children, but adults and teachers and everybody else. The loss of the ability to control your own health and make your own health decisions seems to be a very ethical concern. And, you know, that informed consent idea, that's very important. That ethical issue, is that primary in terms of what you're arguing here?
Oh, most definitely. And if you look at healthcare in the United States, it's always presumed that parents have the best interests of their children in view. And in any case, to override, you know, parental rights requires very strong empirical evidence that the parent's potentially harming your child. And this is the kind of evidence that's not forthcoming in this particular case. In an individual case, I'm not talking about public health in this matter, but if a mother is not giving the appropriate medical therapy to a child, then we could go to the courts and get permission to override parental autonomy there, but that's very rare. And there has to be some real strong evidence. And public medicine has also maintained high standards for interfering with personal liberty. So, yeah, most definitely this goes to the heart of the ethical stance against those who want to abridge the rights of parents to decide for their children, especially in the light of conflicting evidence. Now, you know, if there was unequivocal evidence that these vaccines cause diseases like autism, we certainly wouldn't want to take them. But the point is, there's evidence that's pretty strong, you know, that there's a connection between autoimmune responses and autism, and in populations of individuals who have family histories of autoimmune diseases, there's a high incidence of autism. And given that kind of information, and given the paucity of studies that have really had adequate samples to foreclose these issues, if you're risking millions of people, because one out of every 68 has autism, so this is not a small deal here. When you're risking so many millions of people, you better be damn sure that you're right about this. And when you look at some of the studies that are out, notably the most recent studies, the samples are very inadequate from a logician's perspective. I've studied applied logic for many years, and when I look at these things, I'm really dismayed, by the inadequacy of those samples.
We're speaking with Dr. Elliot Cohen, a professional ethicist, philosophical counselor, editor-in-chief of International Journal of Applied Philosophy. Elliot Cohen also, for full disclosure, contributes to Project Censored's work each year and actually contributes a very important component of our program called Ethics Alerts, applying ethical analysis to underreported news stories. And we are also now joined on the phone. Cheryl Akison, the investigative journalist, had to step off. She was actually in transit, but we are now joined on the phone by Lori Martin Gregory. Lori has a history as a former investor relations consultant on Wall Street for pharmaceutical and biotech companies. She also has a background in media, and for some time now, she's been the editor and publisher of a website called the Mom Street Journal, momstreetjournal.com, and she writes about issues on parenting and health and public health and so forth. But she actually has just been in Sacramento talking to lawmakers about Senate Bill 277. And Lori Gregory joins us by phone for an update. Lori, are you with us?
I am, Mickey. Thank you so much for having me.
Lori Gregory, you, I'm assuming, met with various people, talked with various people. And again, one of the things we've been talking about on the show today, Elliot Cohen's on with us talking about ethics and little conflicts of interest. But possibly we can get into a little bit of that between the pharmaceutical companies and health practitioners and so forth. You worked in Big Pharma for some time, and you sort of have changed over a lot of that. People can learn more at your website, Mom Street Journal. But tell us a little bit about how that background has led you to where you are now.
I'm still a proponent of science. Part of my role in investor relations when I worked for biotech and pharmaceutical companies was helping to take complex medical concepts and putting them into layman's terms. I saw some of that same struggle in Sacramento, and I think part of it is the emotionality that health is personal, it affects everybody, it's a universal theme. But you've also got legislators that are so overwhelmed. And by design, the governing system really doesn't serve the people by the way in which it governs. So, for example, lawmakers are teaching me that often in 1 week they receive 200 bills that they need to review, understand in depth, and be able to then vote on determining policy for the state of California. I have been writing about this issue for 8 years. Every day I learn something new. I can't imagine the challenges from the legislative perspective of trying to process 200 bills, to the level of depth of becoming an expert. So I saw a lot of topic fatigue, but I think that, it is really important that we keep having the dialogue. That's what's so wonderful about Senators Pan and Allen, is that they have brought this subject to the forefront, and we're now having the conversation, and it's way overdue.
Well, Lori Gregory, actually, we're not having a dialogue, though. We're trying to have a conversation, of course, here on the program, but Senator Pan, I contacted his office. I'm sure he's busy. We couldn't get certain people to come on the show in favor of SB 277. But the point is that, they get in front of the microphone, they make press statements, the media doesn't necessarily go out and fact check the remarks. I mean, unfortunately, Senator Pan has been caught in numerous false statements,
mm-hmm.
And the corporate media has done a lackluster job of trying to deal with that. Of course, people like Cheryl Akison that we've had on has tried to, write about these issues. You, certainly at your website, Mom Street Journal, have. Caitlin Obolsky, who was on the show earlier, also has blogged and written about these things. So yes, I think you're right. We do need to have a dialogue and a conversation about this. But it seems like the TPP, SB 277, is on a fast track, and it hasn't gone through many committees at all, particularly the Education Committee in the Assembly, where one would think that that would be a huge factor to discuss, given how many students are affected.
Well, the good news is the vice chair of the Education Committee and Assembly, Rocky Chavez, has come out as a champion for us. So he is championing right now the opposition, and he understands the significance of this bill And, you know, he's not afraid to stand up for our rights to determine what is best for our children and for our own bodies. He understands that it's really a civil rights issue here.
We're almost out of time for this segment, I'm afraid. But Elliot, I just wanted you to have a sort of a statement here about some of the things that we've been talking about and certainly the connections. I mean, Senator Penn has received money, a lot of money from the pharmaceutical industry. One of the bigger proponents of bills that require mandatory vaccination include Dr. Paul Offit at the University of Pennsylvania with a Merck endowed chair there. And he's made a lot of money off of his own work in the vaccine business. What can you say about why it's healthy to ask certain questions about these relationships?
Conflicts of interest in medicine are supposed to come out. Medical journals need to disclose the backgrounds of the individuals who are doing studies and putting this information forth. And I find that a very closeted, very surreptitious way in which these companies are operating. Let me give you an example. There's an article in JAMA in April 2015. It's a study denying any connection of the MMR with autism. And one of the individuals who did the study is connected to the Lewin Group. And I think Cheryl Atkinson had brought this out. This group has very big ties to Big Pharma. And there's no statement in there after he's related to works for the Lewin Group that he's in bed with Big Pharma, but basically that's what it's saying. And so here's a group that comes forward with a study, and the way it's even presented is, well, you know, people believe that there's a connection here and we're going to show that there isn't. And here's the evidence. Well, the sample is all messed up. It doesn't have a sample of individuals who haven't been vaccinated to compare what they're claiming to. There's a lot of other flaws in the study. But nothing is being said by media. The journals are not getting behind these tacit, quiet connections to Big Pharma, and Big Pharma is calling the shots.
Elliot Cohen, I just wanted to thank you for your statements and for joining us today. And I wanted to go back to you, Lori Gregory, but we only have 1 minute remaining in the segment. But go ahead.
One thing I want to point out, which is a really important piece of information that I've recently discovered, I was analyzing the vaccine court injury report settlement, and I ended up writing about it. You can go to themomstreetjournal.com and see the story. It's on the front page. What I discovered, Mickey, out of 10 of the vaccines that are mandated by 277 are responsible for more than 50% of the $23 million in vaccine injury payout for 2014.
So this is available at momstreetjournal.com, and I know you have a lot of other articles and videos there, and people can see your work there. Lori Gregory, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored show today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Elliot Cohen, thank you so much for joining the Project Censored show today, and I know we'll be having you back on about some of your books on surveillance in the near future.
Looking forward to it, Mickey.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on over 20 stations around the United States. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. And please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of our brothers and our sisters. The people together.